Martha Covington arrived at Campbell in the fall of 1995, and by the time she graduated 4 years later, was one of the best hitters in the history of the Atlantic Sun Conference. The fast pitch era of Campbell's softball program was less than a decade old when Martha first stepped into the left-handed batter's box. Campbell was coming off its first NCAA postseason appearance under coach Julie Brzezinski and won the league title with a combination of pitching, defense, and execution on offense. Enter Martha Covington, who showed Campbell fans that a hitter could display power without sacrificing contact. She shattered school records for doubles, home runs, total bases, and RBI. She set a school mark for slugging percentage, and her .429 batting average is second all-time in program history. Martha was a four-time Atlantic Sun first-team all-conference performer, one of just 10 student-athletes to accomplish that feat since 1986. She was a three-time All-Southeast Region selection and still ranks among the A-Sun top five career leaders in average, hits, and doubles. She was the A-Sun batting champion in 97, 98, and 99. It's no surprise that Martha was selected to be a member of this year's Campbell Athletics Hall of Fame induction class. My name is Stan Cole, class of 1987, and this is our next installment of Tales from the Creek, where we visit with the people who've made this place special over the years. I'm delighted to be joined today by former softball standout and Campbell Hall of Fame member Martha Covington. Welcome to Tales from the Creek, Martha, and thanks for taking the time to visit with us.
Thanks, Stan, for having me.
Martha, let's just start out at the beginning. Tell us about where you grew up and how you got started in sports.
I'm from a small town in Virginia, south of Richmond, north of Petersburg, called Colonial Heights. I grew up in a family of, I have an older brother. I am the only girl in the family. There's six other cousins. So I kind of grew up playing baseball. My brother was a big part of that. So I spent until I was 14 years old playing baseball. Then I transitioned to fast pitch softball with the Richmond Diamonds. I played for them for 4 years and traveled the country. And that's how I met Coach B during that time playing junior Olympic softball.
So did you play other sports? Was it just mainly baseball your thing?
I played baseball. I was played basketball in high school and indoor and outdoor track.
Right. So when did you figure out that softball was going to be what you pursued over the other sports?
I love the game of baseball. However, back in the day, girls couldn't play baseball in high school, so softball became my next option, and I loved it from the day I stepped on the field at 6 years old playing t-ball.
How easily did you make the transition from overhand to underhand pitching as hitting?
Pretty easy. I spent a lot of time working on it. I had a private hitting instructor named Bob Brawley out of Mechanicsville who helped me transition from softball to baseball to softball. He actually was a hitting instructor or played in the Mets organization. Coach Smith, he was friends with Coach Smith.
Right.
So he helped me transition to be able to learn how to hit softball.
Now, I understand that your dad was quite the outdoorsman.
Yes.
And that your family had a lot to do with a lot of other interests outside of organized sports. Tell me a little bit about that side.
We grew up hunting and fishing. My dad was a competition fisherman out of Hatteras, North Carolina. I spent most of my summers in Hatteras until I was 12. And then after that, my dad quit everything to travel with me all over the country to play softball.
So you are saltwater, deep sea fishing or what?
So basically what Wicked Tuna is now is what my dad did.
Holy smokes.
Yeah. He had, was in with three other guys that had a couple boats, and they spent Friday, Saturday, and Sunday fishing. And then he came back home and worked for VDOT the next 4 days and then went back and did that.
So was this one where they were going landing these mammoth tunas and then and preparing them to sell even over to Japan or wherever for sushi grade? Or
they came into Oregon Inlet, and wherever it went after that back in the day is where it went. I have no idea. But they brought everything into Oregon Inlet and dropped everything off and sold it.
Did you get to go out on the boat, too?
As much as I've been around on boats my entire life, I'm petrified of them.
Really?
My brother went fishing with them a lot.
But so the salt water, the deep sea didn't float your boat, so
not
to speak.
Not my cup of tea. No.
Well, what kind of fishing is your cup of tea? I mean,
I used to do a lot of just freshwater stuff. I was always down in Hatteras with them, pulling things off the boat, cleaning the rods, doing all that stuff. I couldn't see land, and there was jaws.
Well, it takes somebody that, you know, I mean, obviously people can watch Jaws now, and it's certainly not as scary now in these days of where the special effects and movies are so much more real, I guess we could say. But I was probably about 10 years old when Jaws came out, and I've never seen the movie, but I was so scared to even go watch it when I was a young teenager or anything like that. And, you know, I understand that feeling. I love the salt water, but I do like to be able to be in the ocean and feel sand under my feet too.
Yes.
Yeah. Cause I feel like I'm pretty good chance of there not messing with a great white or anything like that.
That movie Jaws ruined me fishing, deep sea fishing.
How about hunting? What did y'all hunt for?
We deer, turkey. That's been one of my passions in life is hunting. I got that from sitting in the woods with my mom. I had two options. I could stay at home with my grandparents or go hunting with my mom and dad and brother. My mom and I raised the dogs, and my dad and brother ran the dogs. We had a pack of about 40 up until 2017.
So that all involves, you know, getting up before dawn, right? Tell us a little bit about, you know, this is not necessarily what every, 10-year-old, 12-year-old kid's doing on a Saturday or Sunday morning.
And we spent a lot of time training dogs and tracking them before GPS or what we call beep beep collars were out.
Right.
So we spent a lot of time. We would release the dogs, they'd have to come back to us, or if they got on another piece of property, we'd spend hours looking for them and, you know, getting them all back in at night, because that was our biggest thing, is making sure we had our pack back in, because they were like pets. They weren't like anything else. I can't explain it. They were our pets. Our property is about 45 minutes from where I grew up. We were down there 4 or 5 times a week, taking care of them. I learned how to farm down there. We had 85 acres of open fields that my dad taught us to farm. They believe in sweat equity. So in order for us to be able to hunt during hunting season or fish or anything else, enjoy the property that we had to put in the time. So I learned at a young age what it was like to put in the time to make yourself available to do the things you enjoy.
From what I understand, the sweat equity, the hard work, the hours of dedication, you took that from what you learned growing up and applied that on the softball and baseball field.
I did.
Tell me a little bit about your philosophy there.
I spent a lot of time practicing. I knew that there was always somebody out there who was better than me, and I wanted to be the best. My mom and dad spent hours with me throwing. I was in the 8th grade when the varsity coach came down and said, we need a pitcher for next year. And I had only played baseball. I only pitched overhand. So I spent a whole entire year learning how to pitch. Came in as a freshman, was not a very good pitcher. I was, in fact, terrible. I hit everybody. I was a third baseman, or I played second and outfield at that time. And they transitioned me to a pitcher because they had no one that could pitch. So it took me about 2 years to get that down. And I spent 45 minutes a day pitching to my dad. And then we went to a batting cage where I had $5. You got 6 tokens, and I could hit $5 worth of tokens every night. And then when it got cold, we would go up to a tennis court that we had access to and pitch. And then we would just work on batting with swings and stuff because the batting cages were closed.
Right-handed pitching. Did you always bat left-handed?
I always batted left-handed. My mom tried to change me one day. I was young. My dad came home and goes, leave her alone. She's going to hit left-handed. My dad is also right-handed, left-handed. His twin brother is completely left-handed.
Well, and I always argue, and we have these discussions, you know, old sports dude talk about who's got the prettiest swing of all time, who's the greatest hitter of all time. And, you know, of course, Ted Williams is reputed, you know, left-handed batter. And then we always talk about the beautiful left-handed swing in baseball. And then the argument always comes down, well, if Ted Williams is the greatest left-handed batter, who's the greatest right-handed batter? And everybody has to kind of scratch their head and think a little bit about it to have to come up with something, because it's almost for as long as I've been around sports, you know, Ted Williams retired in 61 or something like that, 60. And I, it was always, we were told it was Ted Williams. Who were some of the players that you looked up to? Do you have any favorites?
My favorite baseball player is Cal Ripken Jr. And I have followed him since I had box seats at the Richmond Braves growing up. And it was, I believe, a Sunday game when he was at Rochester. He wasn't down for very long, and I got to watch him play. I was young. I mean, I was very young. I think I was like 5 or 6, maybe. And I fell in love with him. And I was very lucky. I grew up in Colonial Heights, where Johnny Oates was from. Well, he was from Prince George, but I went to school with his kids.
Oh, wow.
So I had opportunities, unfortunately, that I didn't take because I was playing summer ball. But I got to talk to Cal on the phone, and then I recently got to meet him through one of my friends, Michelle, who played softball at Campbell, took me to the Durham Bulls game. And they all hoodooed me into bringing my license plates, because my license plate said RIP 8KN my entire life from 16 till he retired. I took him off my truck, and I got him to sign those, and I've met him several times since then.
That's amazing. And now, it's not uncommon, though, because there are people of a, you know, there is a probably a 20-year swath where they, you had a good chance. If you asked a baseball fan who your favorite player was, you would get the answer that you gave us, because he was there every day. I mean, what was it about his game that appealed to you, Martha?
His ethic, his work ethic is impeccable. I mean, it's just, I watched him play, listening to him talk about the stuff that he put in, like, you know, playing basketball in the off season, making sure he was, you know, taking reps when nobody else was, just admiring the work that he put in. I think if you do the work on the backside, the front side is made so much easier. I loved practicing. The games were just easy to me. It was just fun.
Let's circle back a little bit. You mentioned your folks, you know, basically dropped everything to invest in your playing career. Tell me a little bit about what, you know, whereas you had been used to going down to Hatteras or going out to hunt and stuff like that. Tell us what some of those weekends looked like for travel ball and things like that, your career there.
So I started playing for the Richmond Diamonds 18 and U when I was 12.
Wow.
There was six of us that came in at that year that were 12. And we played all the way up until 96. I actually played my freshman year that summer. I got to go home and play. So we would practice in the winter. We practice every Wednesday night at a local high school. But the fundraising was the stuff that got us. My parents had to, Dad sold his interest in boats. He stopped doing all of that, came home, made sure that my mom had off. They saved all their time and could travel with us through the summer and then fall ball. And then we had a break. Hunting season came in, so Dad was like, we're hunting.
Right.
And then spring ball came back in with softball for high school. And then we started again right back up in June to play summer ball. We played over 72 games plus every summer, traveled up and down the East Coast. A normal weekend for my parents was to New York at the time and back. And on Sunday or Monday morning, to go back to work.
Oh, my goodness.
And it took them, my parents couldn't afford it. I did so much fundraising, and people don't know this about me, that I hate Krispy Kreme donuts. I can't stand donuts because I was selling 100-plus donuts on Friday and then 100-plus donuts on Saturday so my parents could afford for me to play. Our organization had a thing where if you fundraise or you could write a check, my parents were not going to write a check. That's just how they were. Couldn't afford it, for one.
Right.
But I would have per diem, basically, where the Diamonds would pay for my hotel and my meal. My parents had to pay for their travel and their hotel, and they went everywhere with me. I think my freshman year, my first year with the Diamonds, they missed one tournament in South Carolina, and they traveled everywhere, to Colorado, to California, to Minnesota, all over the place watching me play.
Do you feel like being invested in it from that fundraising side and knowing what your family was giving up, do you think it made you focus more or value the experience more, even as a young teenager?
Absolutely. I knew that at any moment this opportunity would be taken away from me, and I wanted to make sure that I had the ability to put myself in front of college coaches to potentially get a scholarship. My parents told me basically that you can get a scholarship, or your aunt works at the local community college, Don Tyler at the time, and you can get your education there. My parents couldn't afford for me to go to school. I mean, I had schools all over the country looking at me, and I knew that I needed to be home. That made sense because there was things that needed to be done, so that's one of the reasons why I came to Campbell.
When did you realize, Martha, that, when did you have the goal of playing? Do you recall what age it was?
I was young. I was very young. That was one of the things that I always knew, that batting would take me wherever I wanted to go. It was a God-given talent, and I enjoyed it. I was a decent fielder, in my opinion. I loved playing third base, and that was, you know, obviously taken away from me in high school because they needed a pitcher. But in summer ball, I actually played right field. So when I came to Campbell, I sat my first year as in I was just a DH.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't consider that sitting now, but at the time I was devastated. I was like, I'm just going to hit. I had four opportunities to play, which was a huge part of our success that year.
Right.
And because I was playing behind Melissa Mullins at third base. I mean, that was, I mean, she was amazing. So my sophomore year, I came in and played third, which I absolutely loved. And then senior year transitioned to first. But it didn't matter where you put me. I just wanted to play. And I knew that that opportunity at any time could be taken away. So I valued every second that I could get.
Martha, you had a couple of club teammates, Michelle Little and Jessica Pleasance, who went on to play at Campbell. Was that a factor in your college choice, knowing somebody? Or what was it about Campbell?
I knew nothing about Campbell. And for me to be honest, when Coach B invited me down and I came up, Leslie Campbell, I looked and went, where are we? I don't know if I can play here. My dream school was Carolina, and that just wasn't a fit for me. And my dad's like, give it a chance. They liked the fact that it was in the middle of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I grew up pretty much in the middle of nowhere. My city was 8 square miles, but I spent most of my time in the county, which is Prince George. And I loved that atmosphere. And so I came back a second time and I was like, maybe I can do this. My other options were massive schools. And I knew with my learning disability that I needed a small environment. And I came back and I kind of fell in love with it. And it's just one of those things that has shaped who I am. Campbell has been amazing for me.
Tell me a little bit about your coach, Julie Brzezinski. You know, Coach B built this program from the ground for 7 or 8 straight years, set school records for most wins in a season, then decided to move back up north to be closer to her parents who were getting older, and has been at Fairfield forever. It seems we see her every few years. She comes down and plays in a tournament, and it's wonderful connect. But share with our listeners a little bit about Coach Julie Brzezinski.
I met Julie when I was 12, and she watched me all the way through when she recruited me. She heavily recruited me. I will be the first to tell you my grades were not the best in high school. She stepped out on a limb for me, and I was forever grateful for her to get me into Campbell. But we had a really good relationship. It was devastated when she left. I almost transferred. But I had made a commitment to the university, and I knew that I was getting a phenomenal education here. So I didn't leave when Julie left. But she was one of those people that believed in me.
Mm-hmm.
She showed me, you know, hey, hard work can get you here. Like, I spent, I'm not lying, my freshman year in her office at the natatorium. I had a desk set up. She said, if I can get you through the first year, you will never leave Campbell. She said, you will graduate and I will have done my job. And she spent a lot of time with me. A lot of people don't know that, but I was in her office every day before practice and after practice trying to graduate, trying to get my freshman year under me.
What did you learn from Coach B?
The dedication. I've learned that she was here. It was more about the relationship she made with her players as opposed to what was happening on the field. She valued what happened on the field, but I think she set that foundation for us to want to play for her. She was very easygoing. She invested a lot of time in us. She did in me. And she wanted the best for us. And she was just a very personable person. And it felt like she cared more about us as academics and graduating, what we were going to do after college, than on the field.
Wow. But that still translated into success on the field.
Absolutely.
What other, you know, memories do you have when you think back on your time? It's, you know, whenever I see someone I haven't seen in a while, like, you know, when we greeted each other, it always, there's no way it's been 25 plus years since we've laid eyes on each other. And it just kind of blows your mind, because I'm kind of like sitting here and people come and go and they circle back and all this. But when you look back and think about your time at Campbell on and off the field, what are some of your best memories?
I have a lot of them. I had some amazing professors here. One in particular was Donna Woolard. If it wasn't for her, I think every time that I decided to quit and she picked up the phone, I called my mom and said, okay, she's on the verge of quitting. What do I do? She had an amazing relationship with my parents. She took me through not only undergrad, but grad school, because Dr. Davenport loved her to death. But I swear I was going to quit about 300 times in grad school. It was just the academic and the rigor here is so tough, or it was at the time. I'm assuming it's only gotten worse with the addition of the medical school and everything else that's going on here. But I had some fond memories of the classroom, like maybe not doing so well in Religion 101. You know, I had to take that twice, but Coach B made me sit through my freshman year.
Mm-hmm.
The reason why I didn't do well in that class was because I had knee surgery. People don't know that I tore my meniscus in October weightlifting and came back and played for 64 games my freshman year. I missed one game at Stetson. But the academics that were here, the professors that got me through, the family atmosphere is what kept me here.
Oftentimes people describe their teams as a family. Who were some of your family members on your softball team?
My best friend, Michelle Hannon. We weren't supposed to be friends. And when I tore my meniscus, Coach B is like, you have to go work with her. So Michelle came over a couple times a day and made sure that I was doing my exercises. She was basically mentored me my freshman year. Mo, I loved Mo. She helped me through the playing behind her, which is a tall bill to fill my second year here. But she helped me. Who else?
And Melissa Mullins, for folks who don't know her, this is one of the happiest people I've ever come across in my life. I rarely would see her. She's very determined, but it always seemed like even if she had, she was gritting her teeth, like Charlie Brown talked about, grit your teeth and try harder. She always seemed like she had a little smile, a little grin all the time. Every time she was always happy, it felt like.
Absolutely. She's just a one-of-a-kind individual who you're having a bad day. Mo was there. She could talk you out of pretty much anything. And she was that person in the dugout. Was like, it's going to be all right. Like, you didn't get the hits that you wanted, but this is what we're going to do next time. She was very much a mentor to me. Jim Bernard was a pitcher that came in after us. And I played against her in summer ball. And, she was one of those people that, with everything that she was struggling with, she brought a lot to the table as a person and as a teammate. It always didn't come off that way, but Jen was 100% for the softball program and making it better. And we had a lot of people that, wanted to make us better. And it was kind of like we tried to form that family relationship. And we did, because we had a lot of fun outside of,
sure,
we had a lot of things we probably shouldn't have been doing at Campbell University. It's still a college. We got to have a little fun.
Absolutely. Martha, you were a physical education major. What made you decide on that path and how it helped you prepare for a career?
My first degree was biology.
Wow.
I wanted to be a forester, and Campbell didn't offer that. And I had talked to Dr. Everhart, who was my advisor at that time. And he had said, well, you can go to NC State. Well, looking at NC State going, that is a massive school. There's no way I'm going to make it to NC State. I decided to keep my biology degree. I had a minor in that. And then I went over to physical education. I was like, well, I like this in high school. I'm athletic. And then I met Dr. Woolard, and that pretty much sealed the deal for me. Just the way she teaches classes, just the way she cares about her students. And I've been teaching physical education and health for 22 years now at the same school.
Our guest on Tales from the Creek is Martha Covington, class of 1999. Softball standout and 2026 Campbell Hall of Fame induction class member. Martha, as you look around the campus, things sure have changed in the quarter century since you played here in the few years before, when you even came here on your visit or as a freshman. What are some of the big things that you see that are different here than from when you were around as a student?
If I remember correctly, Carter Gym was the smallest gym in the NCAA history. And we have a massive Gore Arena now, which I've been in there several times. It's what you feel like coming to a Division I, mid-major Division I school should feel like. The addition of football, which I never thought we would see. Our soccer program was the thing back in the day. They were always very good. And then I come up 421 today, and I've been here several times since I left. And I look at the football stadium going, wow, we've come into the big time here with this football stadium. And looking at the student center, the softball field has always been one of the better fields, in my opinion. Coming up back in the day, we didn't have the SEC, and there were a ton of schools that didn't have softball, and we had a phenomenal field, but now it's turf. It's gorgeous. I just think that the university has literally spent a great deal of time and money into athletics.
The team now dresses in the McLeod Fieldhouse, which is just a few steps away from Amanda Littlejohn Stadium, which is this enclosed, beautiful area where the softball team plays. Share with our listeners a little bit about what your dressing room facilities and what your game day experience felt like when you were there.
The dugout or the attached shed on the dugout, or you just dressed and walked to the field or drove to the field, mm-hmm. or already dressed when you got here. Away games, we dressed on the bus. We didn't have the nice facilities like the dressing areas. We had an amazing batting facility. Indoor facility was built, I think, my second year, which I lived in that. So we had some amazing facilities for the time, but, you know, you keeping up with every other school is very hard to do when you mm-hmm. guys have started matching that, which is great to see.
Your teammate, and as you mentioned, your best friend, Michelle, shared with me that you like to talk hitting and baseball with our assistant baseball coach at the time, Randy Hood.
I love Randy.
What did Randy do to help your career?
A lot of it was mental stuff, talking about hitting and understanding that, you know, softball and baseball are a game of failure. You're going to have those. I struggled really hard with not performing for my team, whether it was a line shot down the left field line and it was caught and I didn't get on base. I didn't do my job. Like, he talked me through a lot of the mental aspects of it. We talked a lot about technique. Because my hitting instructor was baseball and Coach Smith was really good friends with Bob Riley, we would talk all the time about the differences. And I said, there is no difference. And he's like, well, there has to be. I said, the only thing is my sport is a lot faster than your sport. So I have to be able to be in, you know, my load position a lot quicker than you guys do. And we talked about the differences and stuff. And he put a lot of perspective on the mental aspect of the game for me.
I remember sitting at the scorer's table, which at the time was located right behind the backstop, the chain link backstop, and for your games here in Buies Creek, and noticing how rarely you saw a good pitch to hit. It took them about one series to figure out that this young lady could punish you with one swing. How did you maintain that plate discipline and not go fishing, so to speak?
A lot of practice, a lot of time spent in the batting facility here, the indoor cages. Mm-hmm. A lot of reps, and it was very hard because if I didn't get hit, cause I think I got hit like 48 times, some obnoxious number. It was just trying to make sure that I could get on base, whether it was a walk or, you know, advancing the runners. I learned how to hit from inside, outside, wherever they would give me a good pitch. I learned to go with it. And that was just discipline in the batting cages.
Was it frustrating when you had to, quote, settle for a walk?
Yes. Yes. I would much rather hit the ball than walk. But, again, whatever it took for us to put runs on the board, that's all I cared about at the time.
Martha, this is the 53rd interview that I've conducted for this podcast series. And no matter what sport, it's a common thread among our alumni that they are oftentimes stay so close to their teammates through the years. Why do you think that is?
I think because of the small atmosphere, we get the ability to be in class with each other. We spend a ton of time together on and off the field. And I think our coaching staff forged that for us and made us with, the Ravenwood team bonding trip. Isn't that what that on the Cape Fear River, isn't that what that place is called? Yeah, we got to go hang out there. Coach B always made sure we had some crazy team bonding stuff. And I think through our failures, we bonded very well because there was so much stuff that happened on that. It rained, our tents got wet. It was people's birthdays and somebody ate all the birthday cakes and Coach B got mad. I mean, we literally saw every, I think, emotion that you could put with 20-some girls together in three or four coaches.
So y'all went tent camping at Raven Rock State Park.
Yes.
And there's nothing more miserable than tent camping in the rain.
Yes. And then people running by and touching the top of your tent. So it rained in your tent. We had a bunch of tricksters on our team. I'm not going to say that we didn't, but we had a great time. And I think through things like that, we became really close to one another.
After graduation, you're selected in the Women's Pro Softball League draft. Tell us a little bit about your experiences playing beyond college softball.
We were in Dothan, Alabama, my senior year, and the Carolina Diamonds actually folded before I could get to play for them. Being drafted was an honor in itself because the league was so young. Mo had gone in as a walk-on. And then after that, I was recruited by the Ray Bestis Breakouts out of Connecticut, who was, if anyone knows who Joan Joyce is, coached at Florida Atlantic.
Absolutely.
And my freshman year, Joan and I had a great meeting in Buies Creek. I actually hit the winning shot to knock them out of the tournament over the right field fence. And through the line, she grabbed me and said, "Martha Kay," she said, "let me tell you one thing. In the next 4 years, you'll never see another pitch from me. You will never beat us again." And Joan and I forged a great relationship. She got me onto the Breakouts. She came and watched me play, as well as Coach B, because she wasn't very far. She ended up coaching for the Breakouts. It afforded me a lot of opportunities throughout the sport, with going into playing for the Ray Bestis Breakouts, which was semi-pro. And then it opened the doors for me to start the softball program at Richard Bland College, which is a sister college to William & Mary in Virginia. I got to start that program. I was there for 3 years, and then I advanced on to Virginia State, which is all hometown for me.
Now, see, I understand, too, that you faced Jenny Finch, who's one of the greatest pitchers in the what do you recall about that matchup?
She actually wasn't pitching at the time, but she was playing, and we got to have some pretty good conversations. I played with Kat Osterman.
Okay.
And I got to practice off of Kat Osterman, and she didn't throw really hard, but she had more movement than I had ever seen. It was a great playing with those people. I mean, I played with all your big names from UCLA and Arizona. When I played Breakouts, we played against them.
You mentioned the program at Richard Bland. Now, you started that program?
I started that program.
Tell us a little bit about that process, that startup process.
Richard Bland, athletic director, found me and came to me. I was coaching high school. I was coaching at L.C. Byrd High School in Chesterfield County, and asked me if I would like to be a coach. And I said, "What are we talking about?" He goes, "I'm starting up a program, and we're looking for someone to start the program, and I've heard nothing but good things about you and read your resume, and I would like for you to do that. You're local. You know what the talent is in the area. We'd like to keep most of our people local and give them a chance in the junior college world to advance up, and you know a ton of people within the softball world." And I said, "Well, sure, let's sit down and talk." So I ended up taking the job, and my first year, we were conference champions. We didn't have enough. I had 6 weeks to recruit a team. I had 12 girls, and by the end of that, we played some obnoxious amount of games. I don't even remember the number. But my team was beat up at the end. I had two pitchers, and they were beat up. So we ended up not winning. We came in second, and I ended up with Coach of the Year that year. And then the next 3 years, we won conference tournament. But I could just never get over the hump because of injuries. It's just a lot of things happened, and we didn't make it to the championship and go on to nationals. But I brought a lot of talent in. My fall ball team that year, my third year, beat Virginia Tech 1-0. In 9 innings, I got a lot of kids into Division I, the UVA, Tech, Norfolk State. So my whole goal was to forge these relationships with these schools and get my kids that didn't get looked, because in Richmond there's 100 and some 18U teams, and I think 16U is probably, I can't even tell you, 500, 600, 700 teams.
Wow.
And it's so watered down, they're not getting seen. So that was my avenue to get them seen, is to have the JUCO have a year there and send them on to wherever their next destination was for softball.
Martha, what are some of the things that you stressed in coaching that made your team so good?
Loyalty to the program.
Mm-hmm.
I think once everything opened up with the transfer portal, kids tend to forget where they came from. Making them understand that you were chosen by this coach for a reason, and regardless of what your personal issues are, because, you know, sometimes you don't jive really well, and then all of a sudden you have just a misunderstanding. And once you get through that, making that program what it was, why you were brought into that program. So loyalty was one of my big things. Hard work, dedication, academics first. My kids knew that if they were not up to standard on their grades, that they were going to come to practice, but they were going to be doing their schoolwork while we practice. So I learned the hard way in high school for a lot of different reasons. I was told that I would never go anywhere. I wasn't smart enough to play in college. My grades weren't good enough. So I made it a mission to make sure that my kids didn't have that opportunity taken away from them with their GPAs.
Tell us about moving on to Virginia State. What helped you make that decision to go there?
I wanted to be a Division I coach, and this was an opportunity to go that route. It was just that next step from JUCO to Division II, which literally they are 4 miles from each other. So I have a decent amount of different local teams that I could stay in contact with and work with. I just wanted to go do that, and then unfortunately my mom got sick, so I had to stop coaching. My mom got cancer.
Mm-hmm. So you moved. Is that what prompted you to leave college coaching?
Yes.
And go back into the education field? Now, when I talked to you on the phone last fall, told me that you were I caught you in the midst of a driver's ed class. And I have to ask you this, what's more unnerving, facing a 70 mile per hour fastball or working as a driver's education instructor?
The driving is probably one of the hardest things I've ever done in my life with these children. I have a break and that's all I have. And I have had kids almost run into the school building, run red lights. And I mean, it's just a lot, but I kind of got hoodooed into doing that with my degree. I have, 10th grade in Virginia is the driver's education point. So you have to have driver's education certification. And my really good friend, Jess, who taught with me for years, her husband left to go coach at another school and they had no one to help with the driver's ed program. So she goes, give me one weekend. Give me 1 7-day driving session with a kid and let me know how it works out. And I've been doing it for 10 years now.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, I sit there and I think about the folks that I know. My driver's ed teacher was the head football coach. And back in this would have been the early 80s, I grew up, my folks let me drive around parking lots. We didn't have a tractor or a riding lawnmower to learn on, like my wife learned driving a lawnmower and a tractor and stuff in the fields. When I was like 11 or 12 years old, my dad let us drive our little tiny Datsun sedan around the parking lot over at Catawba College in Salisbury. So I was familiar with that. And so I started out with my driving and the coaches over there reading the newspaper. And he said, have you done this before? And I rolled down the window and stuck my arm out the window and started doing it. He says, well, let's just keep two hands on the wheel. And he told me where to drive. And then we were driving around Raleigh. Well, and then it was time for me to switch out and go sit in the back seat. And that's one of the most terrified times I've ever been, because the young lady who I was sharing the ride with had never sat in a driver's seat before. And the coach used the old brake pedal a couple times on the other time. And so I can only imagine what it's like doing that as a profession.
It is one of those things where sometimes I shake my head, like, how did I make it out of the car? I always tell everybody, I'm like, well, I'm going to put on my kamikaze helmet and we're going to roll and see what happens. If I don't come back, just know, here are my routes and I'm somewhere on that. Just call 911. Oh, well.
Martha, you joined your brother Rob in the firefighting profession. And tell us a little bit about why you wanted to get involved there.
So in 2003, I came out of my master's program here and I was looking for a job. I was substitute teaching. And my brother has been a firefighter since he's 15. He's now 51. 51, yeah. And he loved it. It was basically what saved him as a young man. He got into the fire department and they raised him. I say that very loosely, but those gentlemen raised him and taught him so much about life, stuff that my parents couldn't teach him. And the camaraderie, the teamwork, everything that comes that translates from softball or any athletic field is the same thing that's in the fire department. So I went into recruit school. It was a volunteer recruit school. And I ended up actually working with my brother for several years as he was a paid firefighter. I was a volunteer and he was my mentor in the back of the ambulance for a long time. And he's now a paramedic and he's very good at his job. But yeah, I followed my brother just because I needed to find a job. And I figured I could get into that. It would be a lateral transfer back into the classroom, because at the time you couldn't find a job. It was so hard to get into education in, you know, 2000s.
Which is hard to understand now, given the struggles that I know that around here, that every year there's hundreds of teaching vacancies around now. Martha, what is it about teaching that keeps you coming back year after year and day after day? Because, you know, my wife Claudia taught for, you know, 15, 20 years, and it can wear on you. What is it? What is it about that that keeps you coming back?
I am at a very low socioeconomic school, and I know that my kids need me just as much as I need them. These are the kids that don't get told, I love you, or you're worth, you know, you have a lot of worth. If you do X, Y, and Z, you can get out and get an education. Your education is what's going to take you to the next level. If you want to, you know, find someone to help you, that's what I'm there for. I get 150 kids every year, and if I can reach one or two of those and get them out of the cycle that they're in, that's what I'm about, is just taking care of those kids. That's what they need. I don't know. I'm a bleeding heart when it comes to kids, and especially the high school age student. They need so much more, in my opinion, than your middle school kids, because whoever teaches middle school, good luck. I don't know how you do that. Elementary, I'm not into tying shoes. However, my kids need me. I've been at the same school for 22 years, and that's what keeps me coming back every day, is just to know that somebody, if I tell them good morning, that's the first thing that they've heard from an adult. So it's the modeling process, I guess, more than anything. Wow.
Martha, outside of work, how do you like to spend your free time?
One of my favorite things to do is investigate the paranormal.
Okay. I'd like go on ghost walks and things like that, or what?
I am very privileged to have a friend that owns his own haunted location in Mechanicsville, Virginia. It's on 7.2 acres of battlefield, the Battle of Bethesda Church. It is the kickoff to Cold Harbor. Most of y'all know Gettysburg,
mm-hmm.
which is they deem as the deadliest battle in the Civil War. However, Cold Harbor was 85% death rate when you were ordered to Cold Harbor from Bethesda Church. It was almost indefinite that you were going to die. In fact, there is a passage that states that all the officers ended their career at Cold Harbor.
Wow. So, now, I understand a little bit about this because our daughter, Catherine, a couple of years ago, went on a bridesmaid's trip down to Charleston, and they took a ghost walk tour. And their guide said, all right, and there was all these historic buildings down in historic Charleston, and their guide said, okay, take out your cell phone and take a picture of this building. It was at night, of course. You won't see something, but then when you pull that photo up on your phone, there's going to be an orb, and that orb is a spirit. And I said, okay, really? You know, that's not just a reflection of a light. And she said, no. And she said, and I was a little bit hesitant. Well, later that fall, we were taking a family trip and we were going through Old Salem in Winston-Salem. And it was at night. We were coming home and we were curious. And so some of those, you know, that we were right next to the old graveyard there and some of the buildings there, the old church and stuff. And sure enough, there was an orb. So I don't know about it. I'm not sure, but I believe it.
So when you take your pictures, you take them in series of three series, you can see the difference between them. Now, orbs sometimes can be dust. I'm the skeptic in the bunch because I want to debunk everything. The one thing that I have a hard time debunking is what we call an EVP, where you record, you sit and talk, and then a random voice comes in that you have no idea. So I've been doing this. God, Michelle took me on my first one down to UT Chattanooga for my birthday. We were in Nashville, went to some other places. I ended up at UT Chattanooga, and that was my first one, and I got hooked. And then I met a couple guys. We have a place called Pamplin Park, Historic Park, in Dinwiddie, which is a massive battlefield. And I met him, and we started just talking and working with different devices and stuff, and I got hooked with the paranormal. I'm 100% a Christian, but I also believe that we walk amongst spirits.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the ones that I've been with have been just, you know, residual, There are some intelligent ones that I have communicated with, but it's either you believe it or you don't, and it's okay, but it's something that I enjoy doing.
That's great. Martha, share with us what it means to you to be inducted into the Campbell Athletics Hall of Fame.
It means that all the hard work that I put in academically and athletically, and all the doubting that I had that I was a decent athlete, I have a very hard time talking about myself, shows that not only what I put in, other people saw that and thought enough of me and my abilities and my records and that I established here were worth everything. It just is that final icing on the cake, if you would say. I mean, it's hard for me to talk about myself in this aspect. It's just one of the greatest accomplishments of my life. I really don't know how to finish this.
Finally, Martha, can you put into words what Campbell University and the Buies Creek community mean to you?
It's my home away from home. It became my second home. The people here not only saw you as an athlete, they saw you as a person. They saw you as someone who was capable of anything you put your mind to. They fostered that love of community, family, and faith within myself and many others that have come through here. It's just a very unique, I think, hidden gem in colleges and universities. I think that people want the big university, but when you come to Buies Creek, you see that the family is here, and it is 100% family-oriented. And I think that's the biggest thing that I left here with, was knowing that not only did I get a great education, but I have a second family. I mean, I've come back several times, and Dr. Willard has had her back to me and was like, Martha Covington, as soon as I speak. So it stays with you for your entire life.
I'm Stan Cole, and our guest today on Tales from the Creek has been 2026 Campbell Hall of Fame inductee Martha Covington. Thank you, Martha, for sharing your Tales from the Creek.
Thank you, Stan.